This is an ABC podcast.
This is Science Friction, and welcome to Real Wild Child, our series full of staggering stories of childhood and science. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Over the years on Science Friction, I've shared all sorts of surprising yarns starring children in extraordinary situations where science and curiosity and often calamity collide with being a kid. And the very first I brought you was this tale of the Nuclear Boy Scouts. Now, nuclear weapons, definitely not toys, right? But what happens when boys get their hands on nuclear know-how? This is the story of two kids, both with a radioactive obsession, but with radically different outcomes. One, a case of young talent celebrated, and the other, talent suppressed.
He wasn't a bad kid. This is the thing. He was really sweet, almost angelic, and he didn't seem, dangerous.
That's journalist Ken Silverstein. He's author of The Radioactive Boy Scout.
He was a teenager, so some teenagers dreamed about baseball. Some teenagers dreamed about bowling or...
Girls.
Exactly. That's how could I forget? Yeah, the way some boys obsessed about girls, David obsessed about nuclear power. It's very strange.
Well, it was about 5 years ago. So I'm Tom Kleins, and I'm a science journalist based in the U.S., and I'm the author of the book The Boy Who Played with Fusion. And I discovered this community of do-it-yourself nuclear physics enthusiasts who are tinkering with nukes, doing things like fusing atomic nuclei and transmuting elements and constructing these amazing atom-smashing machines in their home-built laboratories. And the whole thing was just kind of both intriguing and unsettling. So as this community opened up to me, someone mentioned this 14-year-old kid, Taylor Wilson, who had just become one of only 32 individuals on the planet at that point who had built a working nuclear fusion reactor.
Hang on. Did he really say that?
Had built a working nuclear fusion reactor.
Yes, at age 14, Taylor Wilson had built a nuclear reactor.
And he was by far the youngest. So I said, I got to track this kid down. And that's a story.
I mean, everything about what you've just said there is extraordinary, really. For a start, you'd stumbled across this bespoke scene of amateur nuclear physics enthusiasts doing nuclear physics in their back sheds.
Yeah, and some going about it in very smart, responsible ways. Others, you'd visit them and kind of want a lead blanket over your crotch while they were running their experiments.
Wild, hey? The legendary 14-year-old who Tom mentions, Taylor Wilson, a kid from the deep south of America. Well, 14 years on, he's now a fully-fledged nuclear physicist. And when I spoke to him, he was 22 and described himself as having hit mid-career.
Somewhere along the way, like I said, about when I was 10 years old, I picked up a book.
And that book was Ken Silverstein's The Radioactive Boy Scout, about a teenager with nuclear ambitions, David Hahn.
David grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan.
Eagles on Detroit's best, WRIF.
This city that had fallen on incredibly hard times by then already.
That's life! Life is exciting sound, and Sanyo tape recorders let you enjoy
and very
life.
Suburban life, perfect little neighborhood where kids played in their front yards, rode their bikes around the neighborhood, that sort of thing. Just a sort of classic American suburb.
But behind the facade of a perfect little neighborhood, things are often far from perfect.
He was very troubled, I would say. His parents had a difficult marriage and got divorced. He was moving between two homes. He spent most of his time with his father, but was very close to his mother. And she ended up committing suicide, which was, as you can imagine, very upsetting. So he had a very turbulent childhood. He seemed like an eccentric teenager. He had this brilliance about him when it came to science. But, he had a girlfriend, he had friends, and he was just a little bit eccentric.
It all started, though, with the Golden Book of Chemistry experiments. And at face value, that sounds like such a benign kids' science book, doesn't it? It was far from benign.
Well, in the case of David, it was definitely not benign. I think the edition he got was from the early 1960s, and this was a time where, you know, there was the race to put a man on the moon. And
but why some say the moon? Why choose this as our goal?
It seemed at the time that science was a solution to everything.
We choose to go to the moon.
You know, the book discussed nuclear power and how it was going to generate power that was too cheap to meter. And he was a child, and he bought into it. It was sort of like a fairy tale for him.
So, David started diligently working through the Golden Book of Chemistry experiments. He later told Ken Silverstein that it gave him a sense of control and self-confidence, a way of coping with his family difficulties. And he started to develop a reputation as the mad kid scientist of Clinton Township. By 12, he was easily digesting his father's college chemistry textbooks. By 14, he'd made the explosive liquid nitroglycerine. And his 4th of July fireworks were legendary.
One evening, they heard an explosion and ran downstairs. And yet, David had been doing, I can't even remember the details, some experiment with red phosphorus. He was, you know, practically unconscious. I mean, there were a variety of trips to hospitals.
And there were no limits to David's curiosity, it seems. At one point, he started buying up severed cow heads. Yes, dead cow heads from a local abattoir because he wanted to extract a hormone in their pituitary gland that stimulates tanning. But things were about to get even more out there. David had moved his experiments into the backyard potting shed, working late into the night.
You just go, what? Why didn't anyone pick up on the danger of this? But, you know, in some ways it was preferable to other trouble he might get into. I mean, he seemed like a sweet kid other than for the periodic explosions. It didn't seem that harmful.
A generation later, young Taylor began explosively too.
Yeah, no, I loved experiments like that.
By the middle of primary school, Taylor had set up a rocket lab in his grandma Nell's garage.
So I started to build progressively bigger and bigger rockets, and of course the fuel that carried them aloft. But, you know, for me, that was amazing. For my parents, maybe not so much, because there was the occasional explosion, but it was a lot of fun.
Dad is a Coca-Cola bottler. Mom is a yoga instructor. And they'll be the first to tell you, we don't know a dang thing about science. But it turns out they did know a thing or two about parenting. And Taylor got obsessed with nukes eventually. And I mean, most of us want to keep our kids away from things that can kill them.
Reasonable expectation, Tom Clines.
It is. And especially if it's something that we don't understand. I mean, to work with radioactive materials safely, it's, you know, you really need a fairly high level of understanding. But instead of shutting him down, Taylor's parents brought mentors in. They got him educational opportunities and just really were able to create a intellectually indulgent household for him and his brother.
Early on, you know, it would be me and my dad or me and my mom, and we would go out to some site in New Mexico where nuclear weapons had crashed into the desert or old uranium mines. And that's something I do to this day still all over the world. And I really believe in not only the power of history to inform an understanding. I think that's the best way to learn science, the history of how it was developed. But also I think, you know, that if we understand the history, it can inform, you know, our present.
Before Taylor, as a teen, David's equally enthusiastic quest was to collect every single element on the periodic table, including all the heavy radioactive ones. And like Taylor, he became besotted by nuclear history and radioactive pioneers like Marie and Pierre Curie. But this is where Taylor and David's stories diverge. And David's dangerous trajectory was triggered by, believe it or not, the Boy Scouts.
Okay, down here in the basement, I have a few of my older scout uniforms.
This is the late David Hahn speaking in a 2003 short film, The Nuclear Boy Scout.
I was interested in nuclear energy before I even came in the Scouts.
But who knew the Scouts were also big promoters of the nuclear industry at the time, with all sorts of interesting political and corporate affiliations?
And they explained to me that they had this neat little-looking badge with the atom and electrons circling around it, and I thought that would be cool to have.
One of the challenges Scouts going for the atomic energy badge could do was to build a model of a nuclear reactor. But David decided to get real. Really real. Scarily real.
So this is when he really started thinking seriously about, as crazy as it sounds, to go from, you know, he was putting toothpicks and ping pong balls together and forming elements and
to sort of model nuclear reactions.
Exactly. And this is where he decides, I'm going to basically solve the energy crisis and pursue my very own nuclear reactor.
David wanted to build a fully functioning nuclear fission reactor at age 16 in his mum's back shed. Yep.
Oh, look at this. What's this?
I don't know.
Imagine what that means.
This is Science Friction on ABCRN, Natasha Mitchell with a wild yarn about two radioactive Boy Scouts. For David Hahn, it was Boy Scout propaganda. For Taylor Wilson, his motivations to build a nuclear reactor were triggered by something much more personal, his beloved grandmother, Nell.
She really did determine inadvertently the course of his career, because when he was 11, she got cancer, or actually came back, and it was a very aggressive cancer, and she had lung cancer, and he says, you know, she'd cough up little bits of tumor for me to dissect, and he was finding out how to make a serum and put nutrients in so that he'd grow cancer cells in the medium. And one time he got her to urinate and give him some of the urine for him to check out with his Geiger counter, because she was doing all this nuclear medicine.
Well, she was an incredible influence on me. I mean, she gave me my first lab and said, you know, I can tell you're really interested in this stuff, but also someone who I think influenced me to do things not because they were interesting to me, but because they would have kind of a broader impact on the world. So, for example, some of my early research in cancer detection and treatment, you know, came from her having that disease and feeling like, you know, I wanted to do something about it.
And he had this idea at that point, well, what if these isotopes, which are created in multi-million dollar cyclotrons and so forth, what if he could make them in a way that would be much easier, that you could do in every electrified hospital on Earth and a tabletop device? So that's how he got the idea for building a nuclear fusion reactor that could create medical isotopes. And he's an 11-year-old kid. He was using science in some ways to block out the pain of his grandmother's upcoming death. But he was also using it as an act of defiance against it.
Science as an act of personal defiance. After his grand's death, Taylor Wilson's parents upped stumps and moved the family across the country to a school for gifted kids. Mainstream classes had been boring him to bits. Back in time, a teen David Hahn, on the other hand, bunkered down in his back shed and set out to do what no professional scientist, let alone an amateur, had ever achieved.
Well, the ultimate quest was a breeder reactor. This was the wet dream, if I can say that, of the nuclear industry, a reactor where you put in a certain amount of radioactive material, uranium, and it generated more. It was like a battery that grew stronger over time. So this was the big propaganda of the nuclear industry back then. This was how they were going to create energy that would be too cheap to meter.
And at the tender age of 16, David wanted to make nuclear history.
In life, this is a quote, you know, if you don't take risks, you don't do anything. If you don't do anything, you are nothing, end quote. And that's sort of been my philosophy with chemistry and experiments.
Both David and Taylor went on incredible scavenger hunts for radioactive materials, because when you start looking, you'll find them everywhere.
Oh, here we go. Smoke detectors have one microcurie.
You know, it's just started out with taking a Geiger counter places and finding radioactive things. And
painted on antique clock faces from a bygone era, radioactive radium makes the numbers glow in the dark.
Oh, he's got tons of lead-lined boxes in his garage that he collects it. He's just always never feels like he has enough.
Thorium could be extracted from gas camping lantern mantles.
Some materials, very intense gamma emitters, needed lead shields, things called lead pigs, which were basically just storage containers for radioactive material. And
as Taylor said, I think I had a more advanced yellow cake making operation in my garage than Saddam Hussein ever had.
And Taylor had the internet. What did you buy on eBay?
All kinds of different radioactive things, everything from nuclear fuel to items that contained radium.
And oversight bodies that you'd think would be watching these things a little closer, apparently quite easily fooled. And so there's quite a bit of trade in radioactive material.
You name it. It's surprising what's out there.
But years earlier,
it's a high level radiation.
David Hahn didn't have the internet.
He found that there was a company in Czechoslovakia, I think, that offered uranium samples.
David got seriously enterprising. He duped a company into sending him a stash of smoke detectors on the pretense of a school assignment. He even corresponded back and forth with official energy and nuclear authorities, masquerading as a high school teacher. What he pulled off was incredible.
He was contacting U.S. government agencies, going as far as the former Soviet Union to try to obtain these elements. Of course, we're talking about uranium in rocks. But his plan was to try to obtain these materials and figure out a way to purify it and use it in a nuclear reactor, as crazy as that sounds.
The nuclear boy scout was about to become a nuclear cowboy. Incredibly, David managed to make a neutron gun in his back shed lab, eventually using radium as his neutron source from an old vial of radium paint he'd found left inside an old clock. The next step was to use it to bombard a radioactive fuel to hopefully set off a self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. He tried to extract uranium from ore, but failed. Then he turned to thorium in lantern mantles as his fuel instead.
It's midnight or one in the morning. The shed is
glowing.
Shouldn't we be a little bit concerned about this?
And he was also turning up to school with radiation burns, and still no one did anything.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, the radiation burns one would have thought would have been a tip-off at the school.
But then things got scary for David, because as his effort continued, David's Geiger counter detected significant levels of radiation 5 houses away from his shed. So what did he build in that shed?
I have to say, David was never entirely forthcoming about exactly what he was doing. I mean, what happened in the end was that the police stopped him one night, and in the car trunk, they found a toolbox that was taped shut, with pipes coming out of it. It was just very suspect, yes.
Has this kid got an atomic bomb in his boot?
That's exactly what they thought.
What David had in his car was his model breeder reactor. Only the police didn't know that then. All they knew was the stuff was dripping in radiation, and the radiological emergency response plan was triggered. But it actually took months before they discovered his back shed.
He created something where he appears to have been getting out greater than the sum of the radioactive parts. So it appears that he was generating some sort of radioactive output.
By bombarding radioactive isotopes with neutrons.
Yes. In the end, what happened when the police discovered the potting shed, they had to send in the cleanup guys in moon suits to cut up his potting shed and put it in barrels and ship it off to a low-level radioactive dump site in Utah. So it's pretty scary that a teenager got that far along. And, you know, nowadays, on the one hand, it might be harder to obtain some of these things, but with the internet and a little bit of creativity, one has to wonder what a teenager could do nowadays.
Well, maybe they could do just what 14-year-old Taylor managed to do 13 years later in 2008.
He said, you know, the stuff that kid's trying to do, I think I could actually do it.
I think that was the spark more than anything else, was not necessarily I wanted to do what he did or do things in the way he did, but that this incredibly advanced technology was something that I could experiment with as a 10 or 11-year-old and in Arkansas.
Well, more than experiment, you set your sights on building a reactor.
Well, it became that. I mean, to me, really, it was following the history of nuclear science and technology, right? J.J. Thomson discovered the electron, and that discovery led into the discovery of X-rays, and Röntgen with the discovery of natural radioactivity fogging plates, and then later on, Marie Curie discovered radium, and then her daughter, Irene, discovered artificial radioactivity, and the series of events culminating really in the Manhattan Project.
Taylor knows his nuclear history, and then he made history himself.
Well, in a way, my story was just tracing that history of exploration.
Taylor wanted to build a nuclear fusion reactor so he could probe the nuclei of atoms. From his garage lab, he headed off to the University of Nevada, Reno.
He went right to the nuclear physics department and said to their most famous professor and old German what he wanted to do, and the guy hit the roof and he said, "Yeah, you are just a child. You cannot do this. This is something too dangerous. Get out of here." He ended up going next door and finding another guy who had a totally different reaction, a guy named Ron Phaneuf, who said, "It sounds like this kid knows his chops. Well, hey, I'm going to clear out a corner of my lab in the basement of the physics department."
And that was a good place to do it. I was deep underground in the physics department and wouldn't irradiate the neighbors.
Now, building a nuclear fusion reactor is damn hard. Building one that works, even harder.
You've got to know about machining, you've got to know plasma physics, you've got to know about
nuclear physics,
you've got to know
to
be a bit of an electrician. You've got, you know, incredibly high voltages coming through there. 500 million degree machine. It's hotter than the sun.
And Taylor made it happen.
Taylor made it happen.
With a lot of help.
Against all odds and with a lot of help.
But despite his fame in becoming the youngest person on Earth to achieve nuclear fusion at the time.
And that was a fun day. And
14-year-old Taylor was surprisingly circumspect.
Like, I got this thing and it's sort of cool and now I can do interesting science with it. You know, I was successful in making fusion when I was 14, but, you know, that device doesn't break even or produce more power out than I put in, nor has any fusion reactor that humans have built in our storied history of the effort. It was just unique because I did it when I was 14.
And with that, Taylor's career as a nuclear physicist was unleashed. He won international prizes, met President Obama, has two TED Talks under his belt. Early fame had its challenges for Taylor. When we spoke, he was 22, running his own tech company, research agenda focused on clean energy and touring the world. And of course, since we recorded this interview, scientists at the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in the USA have made fusion happen. Last year, their scientists announced they'd achieved ignition for the very first time in a fusion reaction. That is, it had generated more power than they'd put in. But what happened to the original radioactive Boy Scout after his back shed was raided by authorities and cleaned up by men in moon suits in 1995? Journalist Ken Silverstein.
It's a very melancholy story. It was the high point of his life in a lot of ways. He got a lot of attention. He achieved something quite extraordinary. But he joined the Navy. And then in his early 20s, the bipolar disorder became apparent. He refused to medicate himself, had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol. And as a result, he never was able to harness his talent. Nowadays, he would have generated law enforcement attention, parental attention, school attention. It was a much more innocent time in some ways.
David Hahn died in September 2016. His father, Kenneth, confirmed in an interview with Ars Technica that the heavy doses of nuclear radiation David had probably exposed himself to in his teens was not the cause. A toxicology and autopsy report, he said, confirmed David died of alcohol poisoning. His body was reportedly found in a Walmart restroom. "He could have done a lot more in this world," said Kenneth. "I'm proud of my son."
I mean, bright kids can't do it themselves. That's one of the myths of these gifted and talented kids, that they, if they're so smart, they should be able to do it for themselves. But almost everyone who's a super bright kid and who's gone on to succeed and do great things can trace their success to having mentors and having education, having support of parents or other people, and having a community that was encouraging them and supporting them.
And as we conclude our story of these two radioactive Boy Scouts, separated in time but linked by their talents, I'm wondering, did David ever know that he inspired a 10-year-old Taylor?
I never talked to him personally, but we had a mutual friend, and he was familiar with my story. So, you know, hopefully if that could have been some comfort, you know, later in his life. In some way, you know, if there was a positive outcome of his story, maybe it was that it inspired me, who hopefully will go on to inspire others. And I think that's the story of this all, that, you know, we can only do so much in our lives and the tools that we have. But if we can inspire even more people to go on and do incredible things, I think that will be very rewarding.
And big thanks to Taylor Wilson, Tom Clines and Ken Silverstein. I'm Natasha Mitchell. For more Real Wild Child stories, next episode, a leading Australian scientist who grew up in a cult. I'll catch you then. And catch me over on the Big Ideas podcast now too. I'm the new host of Big Ideas, your front row seat at some of the best talks, forums and festivals across Australia and the world. See you there.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.